This is SciPod, the podcast of New Scientist magazine.
Hello, and welcome to SciPod, your audio guide to the latest and most intriguing stories in science and technology. I'm Bill Oxley. This week on the May 19th edition of SciPod, head 'em off at the past. Why take the scenic route when a shortcut through time is just a dimension away? Game over. What happens when crime in the virtual world starts spilling over into the real one? And from petite planets to monkey conversations to pigeon math, we'll total up the discoveries in this week's science news. But first, for most of us, time is a one-way street. It carries us forward, never back. This property of time has fascinated philosophers and physicists alike. In fact, many physicists believe that the universe is constructed in such a way that traveling backwards in time is mathematically impossible. But what if they're wrong? Recently, one group of physicists came up with a way in which traveling back in time might be allowed by the laws of nature. And unlike most ideas about time travel, this one we can put to test. Ivan Semenek reports.
When H.G. Wells wrote The Time Machine in 1895, he described a device that had parts of nickel, parts of ivory, and parts that were filed or sawn out of rock crystal. These days, no one expects to build a time machine quite like that, but some physicists are on the lookout for mathematical evidence that time travel is possible, at least in principle. Even for a particle physicist, that's pretty way out there. But Heinrich Pace has always found the idea a little bit mesmerizing.
As a particle physicist, I think your motivation to do work is to think about the fundamental principles and what are the fundamental principles which keep the universe going. And I think one of the most fascinating puzzles is what is special about time. Why does time always go forward and never backward? And why can we remember the past but not the future? And so I think it's a fascinating possibility to think about these ideas.
When Pace isn't sailing out on the open Pacific, he's a research associate with the University of Hawaii at Manoa. It was in this capacity that he found himself daydreaming one day at a conference and thinking about, what else, extra dimensions.
So I was sitting in some boring physics talks at these conferences and was thinking about the possibility that somehow an extra dimension could look like a wormhole for a neutrino.
Now, this idea didn't go anywhere right away, but after some idle conversation, two of Pace's colleagues eventually picked it up and made some interesting progress. And so before long, they were all working together on an entirely new way to test for the existence of time travel.
What we were looking into was the possibility that time travel could be realized by past and extra dimensions. And extra dimensions are motivated by ideas to unify gravity and other interactions in physics. So if these extra dimensions really exist and if they have a specific form, then it could be possible to take paths through these extra dimensions which actually lead to time travel.
If you imagine the universe as a big sheet of paper, you can picture why extra dimensions might be useful for time travel. In physics talk, that big sheet is called a brain, as in membrane. Now, if the two-dimensional sheet is flat, the only way to get from one point to another is to follow a straight line. But now imagine making use of the third dimension and folding the sheet back on itself so that two points that are normally far apart suddenly find themselves side by side. That scenario shortens the trip and actually makes time travel possible. There's only one problem with this, however, which is that that kind of folded back universe no longer obeys Einstein's rules for special relativity. At this point, a lesser physicist might be inclined to give up, but Pace and his colleagues took the whole problem one step higher. Instead of folding the universe and breaking Einstein's rules, they imagined what might happen if the extra-dimensional space itself was folded up.
So it's not our universe which is folded in the extra dimension, but our universe remains flat and the extra dimension is shrinked by a so-called warping process. So the specific set of extra dimensions we are looking into are extra dimensions which are called asymmetrically warped, and that means that the measure of space is changing if you go into this extra dimension, and this essentially leads to the possibility of time travel.
Now, before we go any further, you need to know that physicists have come up with quite a few hypothetical time machines over the years. These generally involve wormholes, cosmic strings, and other exotic phenomena that may or may not exist and certainly are not handy. What makes Pace's method of time travel different from these is that it's an idea that we might be able to test right here on Earth. All you need is the right kind of particle.
There are popular scenarios in particle physics which assign usual particles we use in particle physics to the brain, but assign other particles like gravitons to the extra dimension. So these particles can travel in the extra dimension and can be used to realize such behavior.
Gravitons are particles that are supposed to mediate the gravitational force, but detecting one is well beyond current technology. Instead, the idea that got Pace and his colleagues fired up was using sterile neutrinos. Unlike most particles, sterile neutrinos can travel through the extra dimensions, following the shortest path to get from point A to B. No one knows if they actually exist, but if they do, they probably mix with ordinary neutrinos, like the kind produced in particle accelerators all the time. And the best way to get them to mix is to shoot them through solid matter. That's called the matter effect. Put it all together, and you've got a way to test for time travel.
We had the idea for producing neutrinos, for example, at one of the Earth's poles, which is in rest, more or less. But a point on the Earth's equator is moving due to the Earth's rotation. So we produce a usual neutrino at one of the poles, then use the matter effect to convert it into a sterile neutrino. The sterile neutrino takes the shortcut to the extra dimension, is resonantly converted back to the matter effect to a usual neutrino, which could be detected at neutrino detector located somewhere on the equator. And now this detector is moving. So in this moving frame, it looks like the neutrino traveled back in time. It was detected before it was submitted.
So just to recap, you start with an accelerator at the South Pole, you fire your beam of neutrinos through the Earth, the matter effect causes them to change into sterile neutrinos, which can then shortcut across the folds of extra-dimensional space, change back into ordinary neutrinos, and be picked up at a detector sitting on the equator. And since the detector is moving with respect to the pole, from our point of view, those neutrinos would appear to arrive before they've actually left. No one said time travel was easy, but the point here is to test whether time travel is possible at all, and that's exactly what Heinrich Pace is hoping for.
If this scenario could be realized that we are proposing, then by doing these experiments, one could learn, I think, a lot about the nature of time.
The beauty in this idea is that even if time travel doesn't occur, it would tell us something important about the universe. That's not exactly H.G. Wells, but it's what modern physics is all about.
And you won't have to travel far to find out more about Heinrich Pace and his time-warping idea. It's this week's cover story in New Scientist magazine.
You're listening to SciPod, the podcast of New Scientist magazine.
Now, from the London office of New Scientist, here's Caroline Williams with this week's science news.
For the first time, astronomers have identified a solar system in which all the planets are relatively small. Although more than 170 planets have been discovered since 1995, virtually all of them are similar in size to Jupiter, 300 times the Earth's mass. Even when smaller planets do turn up, it's always been in the company of larger, Jupiter-sized worlds. The new discovery, made by astronomers at Geneva University in Switzerland, is a three-member solar system, with planets that only have about 10, 12, and 18 times the mass of Earth. This is comparable to the mass of Neptune in our solar system. These new planets are likely to be gassy giants without solid surfaces, so they wouldn't be ideal places to find life. However, their discovery means that astronomers are getting closer to the holy grail of spotting Earth-sized planets in other solar systems. What you've just heard is the sound of a putty-nosed monkey saying, "Come on, it's time to go." Researchers at the University of St Andrews in the UK were surprised to hear the monkey stringing together simple calls into complex phrases which resemble sentences. The phrase you've just heard is made up of the warning call for when leopards are prowling nearby and a call that warns of predatory eagles. The male putty-nosed monkeys string together two leopard sounds and three eagle sounds to create a sentence meaning "let's go." Importantly, the scientists heard the monkeys using this phrase even when no predators were nearby. The males utter the phrase in the mornings to say, "let's go and forage for food," and in the evenings to say, "let's go and find a place to sleep." The finding is yet another example of speech-like patterns turning up in animals other than humans. If you struggled with logarithms in maths class, you may be dismayed to hear that pigeons understand them perfectly well. Canadian researchers have found that pigeons appear to perceive time on a logarithmic scale. The scientists trained the birds to distinguish between short and long flashes of light. The pigeons would press one lever if they saw a flash lasting only 1 second, and a different lever if they saw a flash lasting 16 seconds. Then the scientists tried medium-length flashes to see whether the pigeons would classify them as short or long. The pigeons changed their answers from short to long at about 4 seconds, rather than the halfway point, which is about 8 or 9 seconds. This makes sense if pigeons perceive time on a logarithmic scale, on which higher values are increasingly compressed together. The results may apply to humans because brains have to prioritize small numbers, which are more relevant in everyday life.
We hope you're enjoying this week's edition of SciPod, and we'd love to know what you think of our podcast. If you've got a comment or suggestion, please drop us a line. Just email your feedback to podcasts@newscientist.com. And now, back to our show.
The rise of the Internet means that people around the world are connected to a degree that was impossible a generation ago. It also means that people can disconnect from this world and immerse themselves in the virtual world of online gaming. At last count, around 30 million people worldwide abandon reality each week to inhabit imaginary realms with names like EverQuest and Second Life. For most, this is a completely benign, if rather time-consuming activity, but for some, the increasing complexity of these games has made it possible to turn virtual reality into real crime. This week, New Scientist takes a closer look at the dark side of online gaming. To find out more, we reached editor David Cohen in London.
David, let's start with the most extreme example in the story, which is when a virtual theft in a virtual world leads to a real murder. Can you fill us in on that story first?
Yes, well, it was in February last year. Two players in China, in Shanghai, who play a game called Legends of Mir. One guy loaned a fellow character in the game a sword called a dragon saber. The sword is a virtual item that they use, you know, to kill monsters and stuff like that in the game. And the second chap, he sold the sword to some third party, unbeknownst to the owner, and pocketed the money. Now, these virtual items, In many of these online games, are worth, you know, hard cash, real dollars. People pay, you know, whatever the equivalent dollars in China, they pay yuan for these items, and he got the equivalent of 500 pounds sterling for it. And when the owner of the sword found out, he wasn't too pleased and asked for it back and said, "Well, yeah, I'm sorry, it's gone." And the owner went to the police and asked them to help him recover the sword, and they said, "Well, I'm sorry, but it's just a game, and there's no real theft of any real item here, so we can't help you." So one night, in a fit of rage, he went over to the sort of the virtual thief's house, his real house, and in the dead of the night, murdered him.
Right, so here's this case where anger or revenge blurs the boundary between the real and the virtual. But really underlying that is, I think, something deeper, which is that money is playing possibly an even bigger role in blurring those boundaries. So in general, how do the economies of these online worlds spill out into real life?
Yeah, that's right. I think the economies of the virtual world have really just mushroomed. They've become huge in the last few years. As more and more people play, obviously there's a greater demand for items. And the way it all started was when people came into some of these virtual games, and when you normally play, you start off very low level with very few special magical items, etc. And as you play, over time, you acquire more experience, so you get more magical powers, and you discover new weapons and things like that, so you become more powerful. Now, people who came into the game and wanted just to leapfrog all that time, and getting that kind of level can take weeks or months even. And people who have enough disposable income in their pockets say to the players who've been playing for a long time, look, why don't you just sell me that item there for $500 or $100 or $50, depending on what they were prepared to pay for it. And over time, sort of a market emerged, and people started putting or advertising virtual items on eBay and, selling them like real goods.
So people are basically taking advantage of what's perceived as valuable in a gaming environment and trading on that value to make real money. How does that lead to abuses or to potential crime in the real world?
Well, I guess wherever there's a place that real money changes hands, then when there's enough people involved, like in any society, some things bound to give, and some people are going to try and want to find some shortcuts or slightly less legitimate ways, at least in terms of the real world. Now, the problem with the virtual world is no one's enforcing any laws to police this kind of thing. So people who are victims of such crimes just have to play along.
So now you say there's no policing in the virtual world, or certainly these games perhaps aren't set up with this kind of trading in mind. And there's this fascinating ambiguity here about what's a crime and what isn't. So how are police agencies beginning to deal with that ambiguity?
It's becoming such a big deal for a lot of people that some of the games companies that run the online games have been forced to start thinking of how to enforce certain kinds of laws and certain kinds of behavior. Now, they're really reluctant to do this because it means, a lot more hassle for them. They start need to be judge and jury and execution. They need to actually set up police forces, and they don't want to do that. This is supposed to be a game, and that would take a lot of resources to do. But in extreme cases, for example, in the same game in Second Life, a group of players in the game worked out some bugs in the game, and they managed to create something that's basically akin to a virtual bomb. And when they set off this this piece of code, it physically crashed the servers that ran the game. So when the game went down, obviously everyone that was playing through those servers also got kicked off, and the company was none too pleased about this, and they argued that it was akin to a denial of service attack that hackers do against websites sometimes, and called in the FBI. And the FBI is now investigating the case, and the company hopes they're going to bring a prosecution against the people who did the act. But see, the action originated within the game but had a sort of a real-world consequence.
It raises yet another interesting issue, which is that in the real world, people are, to some degree at least, inhibited from committing crime because of the consequences of getting caught, or at least the consequences of doing something wrong socially, financially. So what kind of behavior then is turning up online where there's less clarity about what distinguishes right from wrong?
Right. Well, okay. So you hit the nail on the head there. What's been going on is some, as it were, law-abiding citizens or people who just want to play by, decent rules and don't like the fact that people are kind of committing these crimes in the virtual world have begun to try organizing ways of dealing with it. So in one game, a guy has set up a mafia network, and he's got his capos and under capos and his sort of whole crime family there that offers the same kind of services you'd get from a bona fide real world crime family in Sicily or in New York or anywhere else around the world. And, they'll extort, they'll hassle people, all in the game. And they claim they even have ways of murdering characters, which is very unusual because the whole point is when you're a player, then you're paying for the right to play. Someone else shouldn't be able to take away that right.
So, David, how do you see then the games evolving to take all of this behavior into account?
Right, well, some of the games companies are finally realizing they have to institute some form of punishment and policing in these kind of crimes. And what they're doing is they're beginning to bring in systems for punishing characters in the game. So the players, the human beings aren't getting punished, but the characters in the game, who, if they're very attached to them, is equally annoying, do get punished. And they've now done things like virtual prisons. So if enough people complain about your behavior in the game, then the company will teleport your character into this special zone, which in one game, Second Life, they call it the cornfield. And what happens there is every time the player logs on to play the game, he gets taken directly to this place called the cornfield, and all he gets to see is he can drive around in a virtual tractor in a cornfield and watch a video about a child who's fallen into a life of crime and the consequences. And so it's a punishment, a sort of a prison for people who misbehave, to say, look, you're not playing, fair, by whatever term fair the company decides fairness is. And so we don't want you around.
Of course, it makes you wonder what someone who drives a tractor in real life through a cornfield would think of this as a version of punishment. But, just to sort of wrap up all of this, it's a fascinating glimpse into the people that make up this online community. And as you say, some of those people seem to revel in their freedom to shed morality and essentially play bad guys and sort of do things they couldn't do in real life, even if it has real life consequences. Do you think that behavior can affect the way these players interact with people in the real world?
I don't think the problem lies in the amoral behavior, because games, you could argue, many other games are equally amoral when you're blowing things up and killing things and stuff like that, but that's just part of the game. The idea of people stealing stuff and where the law lies between, stealing people's property and all that kind of stuff, that's a bit more difficult. And I would say that, I think people, at the moment, because it's such a grey area, people are getting away with stuff at the moment, which probably is kind of amoral criminal behavior, but it's so societally unclear what's going on. People haven't sort of laid down what the rules are. We don't really know. It's just happening now. It's just begun to happen. But it's going to be a few months, years before we sort of accept that this is wrong socially and should generally not be frowned on and legislated for, something like that. Although I think you shouldn't get too carried away. At the end of the day, it is just a game.
Well, David, it is also just a fascinating story. Thanks for shedding some light on, I guess we should call it, the shady side of the virtual street.
Yes.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, cheers.
And that's it for this episode of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you'll find in the May 20th issue of New Scientist magazine. Also this week, Redesigning Life. Synthetic biologists, or biohackers, get their kicks from taking microbes apart and putting them together in novel ways. Now, the quest to defeat malaria may give biohackers their best shot at changing the world. High risk. The rich forests of India's Himalayan region are quietly disappearing. This week, a special report on what could be the most endangered ecosystem on the planet. And the incredible shrinking iguana. New evidence shows that Galapagos marine iguanas can change their size from one year to the next. Their shrinking secret could help astronauts fight off bone loss in space. All this plus lots more science and technology news, features, and opinion. Remember, only New Scientist brings you the week's best ideas. I'm Bill Oxley. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.
Mission Control. SciPod transmission concluded.